Accession number 3183, reel 1.
Sir Theodore McAvoy, Reel 1. Could I begin by asking you to tell me a bit about your childhood, what sort of family you came from, and where you were educated as a child?
Yes, I was born in 1904. My father was a Congregational minister in Cricklewood, which was then more or less in the country, and I was educated first at kindergarten from 5 to 10, and then I went to the Haberdasher's School at Hampstead and was there from 1915 until 1921.
What were your very earliest contacts with the world of aviation before the First World War?
I was very interested in it right from as far back as I can remember. The Round Britain Air Race triggered an awful lot of interest. I forget when, 1912, I think. And then I used to insist that my nurse took me to Hendon on Saturdays, and we used to watch the racing at Hendon. And then, of course, when the war started, that added a zest to it. I remember I used to take the aeroplane every week. It was a penny, I think, in those days, and I used to take the aeroplane and read it avidly, cut out the pictures and stick them in a scrap album. I knew quite a lot about aviation, almost more than I do now, I think.
And then was your interest in aviation further stimulated by the First World War?
Yes, indeed. And as it went on, my brother became of age to fight and went into the Royal Flying Corps because my cousin was already in it and my brother-in-law was already in it. And my cousin helped to get him into what were then called the Sydenham Cadets. I don't know why. It was RFC Cadets. And he trained as a fighter pilot, a scout pilot it was called then, and went off to fight on camels in Italy, where he was wounded and won a DFC, credited with 6 enemy aircraft shot down. And he stayed on in the Air Force until the end of the war, 1919, when he was demobilised and went back to the firm he was with during the war, before the war, and went out to South America. But I still continued with an interest in aircraft and flying, and had every hope of going to Cranwell until we discovered that it was so expensive. One had to pay £200 a year then and buy uniform and books and that sort of thing. And my father, I think, earned something like £400 a year in those days. And we decided it was too expensive, and I decided to go into civil aviation instead. I was offered a job as a boy improver, as it was called, at 30 bob a week in the aircraft disposal company at Croydon, and they said they would try to teach me to fly if I did well at the technical work.
What did that actually involve?
Well, I used to wash engines in paraffin for the first few months and got very smelly as a result. It was from 8:30 in the morning until 5, as far as I remember, in the evening, and I was in a paraffin bath most of the day. Then I got on to grinding in valves and lapping in pistons and reassembling engines which we'd taken to pieces and overhaul. All kinds of engines, most interesting: Hispano Suiza, Sidley Puma, Rolls-Royce Falcon, Rolls-Royce Eagle, Liberty, Lerone and Gnome. Almost all the engines in use in those days we took to pieces and reconditioned and put together again, installed in aircraft, and I only very occasionally flew as a passenger. And it became clear pretty soon that I wasn't really going to be taught to fly, and my foreman said I was wasting my time, and why didn't I go for a short service commission, which I did, and they found I was young enough to go to Cranwell, so I told them we were too poor to pay for it, and they said go off and borrow the money. And fortunately, an uncle who was fairly well off offered to pay my fees at Cranwell, and a cousin gave my father the money to send me to a crammer. And it was, he was such an efficient crammer that he got me in top with a prize cadetship, which saved my uncle having to pay the fees. So there I was, and I went to Cranwell in 1923.
When did you actually do your very first flight?
My first flight was at Biggin Hill in 1919. My brother-in-law was then commanding the station at Biggin Hill, Group Captain Grenfell, and as I was a cadet in the school cadet corps, I used to go in uniform and fly as a cadet with any pilot who was willing to take me up, and I got quite a lot of flying in the Bristol Fighter, Avro, Bristol Fighter and Avro while I was there, and actually was allowed on occasion to hold the stick and fly the Avro.
In fact, you were telling me last time that someone has, in 1916, had realised what your future was and had given you a book inscribed in a prophetic way.
Yes, she, Elsie Beckinsale, who was a missionary in China, gave me a book called Learning to Fly in 1916 and inscribed the flyleaf, Theo McEvoy, Aviator to Be. And I met her again, she's over 80 now, I met her again a little while ago, and reminded her of this, and she looked in the flyleaf and said, oh yes, if I were giving it to you now, I would say, Aviator, what was?
What was your family's reaction to your wish to join the RAF?
Oh, they did everything they could to help me into it. They were, they knew that it was my only idea, and I probably couldn't do anything else, so they encouraged me.
So you went up to Cranwell in 1923.
Yes.
Let's deal first of all with the basics of learning to fly there. How did you get on with that?
Well, first of, in the first term, we only did passenger flying, and we used to be taken up in Bristol Fighters to sketch villages. The pilot would circle round while we madly sketched and vomited between sketches. It made a lot of us very sick. Personally, I didn't suffer from it, but a lot of fellows got awfully sick circling around these villages. Then in the second term, spring 1924, we started with dual, but as we only flew about once a week, it was a very protracted business. And I can't remember exactly how long my 11 hours were spread, but they were spread over a number of months before I went solo on Avro 504K.
And what was the standard of instruction?
Patchy. Some instructors were very good and some were rather poor, a bit windy some of them, but I was lucky and had a succession of extremely enterprising instructors.
You didn't have the same instructor throughout?
No, not throughout, but I was lucky in having one instructor on Avro's and one on Bristol's, and by the time I went on to DH-9As, it didn't really matter much. One wasn't so dependent on the instructor, but one or two on 9As, but by then one was flying almost entirely solo, and the instructor wasn't so important.
Was there a general feeling at the time amongst the cadets at Cranwell that the arrangements for learning to fly were not all they might be?
Oh yes, there wasn't enough of it. Everybody complained bitterly that we were had to spend most of our time in the classroom or at PT or on the parade ground rather than doing what we all wanted to do, which was fly. And the complaint was that on being turning up to fly, we were told, go and sit on your bottom in the office. So it was known as boffice. And the slightest, well, what we thought, the slightest wind prevented us from flying on account of safety, but we after in our third and fourth terms, in our second year, we got quite a lot of flying. But I only did a total of 71 hours over my 2 years there, which is very little compared to the sort of intensity with which instruction is carried out now.
What was the point of spending that first term simply doing passenger flying? Was it justified to you in any
No, I didn't think so. I don't know, except that they were very short of aircraft and instructors, and Now, I really don't know why we only did passenger flying in our first year, first term.
Was, in fact, the shortage of instructors and planes possibly the... Was that one of the main reason why there was so little flying? Or were there any other reasons that were given you to...
No, I think they had to fit in a certain amount of classroom work on not only on general subjects, but on technical subjects and professional subjects as well. So really, I suppose one couldn't complain too much. But the intensity of the instruction wasn't enough, really, to make for good instruction. It was too spread out.
Did you have any narrow escapes from accidents while you were flying at
Cranwell? No narrow escapes. I had I had two forced landings, one with a broken camshaft on a cross-country on a DH-9A, but fortunately the largest field in Cambridgeshire was underneath me at the time, at St Ives, and I got down into it without too much trouble. And the other time was when a Bristol fighter iced up at a height test. The whole thing got covered in ice, and I wasn't aware of the effect on lift, a coating of ice head on the wings, and so I stalled coming into land and went on my nose. And by the time the experts got out to look at the machine, all the ice had melted, so my stories weren't really believed.
Was this problem of icing up not realised at the time?
I don't think it can have been, no. Certainly the cadets didn't realise it. We were told nothing about it. I suppose it happened so rarely in those days.
You mentioned a bit about what else the education at Cranwell consisted of. Would you like to say a bit more, describe some of the other things that you had to do?
The usual school subjects, English and mathematics and mechanics, dynamics and statics, history, military geography, the services, the Army, the Navy, the Royal Air Force. No, I can't recall any other subjects.
Did you have to spend part of your time with your sleeves rolled up, as it were?
Oh yes, of course, there were workshop periods, quite a lot of workshop, I forgot that. The afternoons went into the workshops for carpentry and rigging and the mechanical side, taking engines to pieces and putting them together again, which I already knew something about, theory of flight and so on.
And what were living conditions actually like at Cranwell at that time?
Very jolly. We were in wooden huts, five to a hut, with a great iron stove in the middle that you used to feed with fuel until it got red hot, and a shower and a bath, and a senior cadet in charge of four of us. And then when we got into the senior term, we had wooden huts with private cubicles in them, which gave a certain privacy. And it was all very jolly.
How strict was the discipline at Cranwell?
Not as strict as it ought to have been in many ways, but much stricter than we liked it as cadets. We were not allowed to go into any town. Some of us did, of course, but it wasn't allowed. And, there were, for quite minor infractions of discipline on parade, fatigues or jankers were awarded, which involved extra parades, dressed up in full uniform at odd times of the day and night, which were inconvenient. But I think that's about all I have to say on that.
What was the daily routine, actually?
As far as I remember, we got up fairly early and a hurried breakfast and then on to parade. Colour hoisting parade was the first thing of the day. And then on to either classroom or flying in the morning, and flying or classroom in the afternoon, and games almost every afternoon, PT in the evenings, PT and or swimming, and then at night one had dinner every night, which one changed into stiff shirt and mess kit and so on, and possibly a lecture or a debate in the evening after dinner.
Were those What sort of subjects were you lectured on or debate in the evening?
Well, the debates were on various subjects of current affairs and so on. We were given a week or two to prepare for what you wished to say, and the debate was conducted within the ordinary debating society rules. And I forget how often they took place. I think about once a fortnight or something like that.
Sounds as if you were kept pretty busy. Yeah?
Oh, yes, but then one had to be, really. There was spare time, but mostly for games.
Were there any bad features of life at all in Cranwell in those early days?
There was a certain amount of bullying when I first went there and before my time, but by the time I left, I think most of the bullying had died out. Chaps who didn't perform properly at their ordeal on the first guest night of term were beagled. They were chased round to camp at night and chucked into an oil sump at the end of it and had to make their own way home and get cleaned up before parade in the morning. But that sort of thing was died out during my time there.
What form did these initiation ceremonies on the first guest night take?
You just had to sing a song, which was a bit invidious, or tell a story if you couldn't sing. And if it wasn't, it didn't go down well with the audience, you were either given another chance or beagled.
Can you remember what you had to do as your first act?
Well, I had to sing a song, and it didn't go down at all well, and then I told a story, which did fortunately go down all right, so I escaped the ordeal.
Were there any cadets who failed to make the grade?
Yes, oh yes, quite a lot. They mostly for inability to fly, which of course wasn't necessarily their fault. Some for indiscipline, which was perfectly understandable, and some for inability to cope with the rest of the work. But I don't know how the fail rate compares with what it is now. I should imagine it was about perhaps 20% in those days.
Were there any people who you knew particularly who didn't make the grade?
Oh yes, one of my great friends failed because he was hopelessly indisciplined. He was just the sort of chap who never could be disciplined and just had to go out. He could never put on his putties to start with. Although he'd survived OTC at Wellington, he still wasn't able to put on his putties properly, although he often wore them over pyjamas.
Was there a weakness then in the system for getting into Cranwell that perhaps he shouldn't have been there in the first place?
Oh yes, of course there was no aptitude testing in those days. You went in, as far as I remember, only on the civil service examination, which was standard for Sandhurst, Woolwich and Cranwell. And the medical exam, I don't think there was any selection system at all, not even an interview. I don't think there was, I don't remember going for an interview. So, of course, it was inevitable that some chaps just hadn't the aptitude, however keen they were on it.
Did you form any impression, either this time or at all during the 1920s, of what the public image of the service that you were going into was, what the public image of the RAF?
No, I don't remember thinking about that at all. As far as I know, we were regarded as fairly, in our own circle, we were regarded as fairly normal types, if we were, of course. But I don't remember any particular public image, or really caring about it much.
In 1925, when you left Cranwell, you were posted to 41 Squadron at Northolt. In fact, just before we get on to that, you did rather well in the end. You did rather well at Cranwell.
I passed out third, which I suppose was all right.
But you did, in fact, get the Sword of
Honour.
Yes,
I got the Sword of Honour, yes.
What was that actually awarded for? Wasn't for the first person?
No. I think the rules were for general influence. As far as I remember, that's what the stated object of the Sword of Honour was. It didn't necessarily mean that you were going to do frightfully well afterwards. If you look at the lists of passings out from Cranmore, you'll find that the chaps who got Swords of Honour, chaps who were under officers and got Sword of Honour, very often fell by the wayside. And the chaps who perhaps didn't even get to NCO rank, or perhaps corporals, went on and blossomed later on. So there's... it's also difficult to tell at an early stage how well a chap is going to do ultimately. I don't know whether we've solved that problem yet.
When you went on to 41 Squadron then at North Holt, what did the actual base at North Holt consist of at that time?
It consisted of a station headquarters and one squadron, which was 41 Squadron on Siskins. And as far as I remember, at that time, although communication flight. Oh yes, there was a communication flight, inland area communication flight, which was a small unit with Bristol fighters for headquarters communication use. But the unit I joined was number 41 Fighter Squadron, which had been fairly recently re-equipped with Siskin 3s, having had snipes.
Did you have any problems converting to fly the Siskin?
Oh no, none at all. It's a delightfully easy aeroplane to fly. And if you could fly a Bristol fighter or a 9A, Siskin was extremely easy. I think I had one dual flight with Roy Brading on a dual Siskin, and then I went off in the solo Siskin, and from there it was plain sailing.
Were you using the Siskin 3 throughout?
Siskin 3 for about a year, and then we were re-equipped with the Siskin 3A, which had a supercharged engine and a higher performance, which wasn't quite as nice as an aeroplane to fly. A little trickier to handle on the ground.
Did you normally have the same plane throughout when you were in the squadron?
Yes, you were a sort of established flying officer in the squadron, you were allotted an aircraft, and you flew it all the time, except when it went in for periodical servicing, when you used the reserve aircraft of the flight.
Did you take a close interest in its service?
Oh, very much so, yes. And you had the same crew all the time, and your fitter and rigger were very much part of the crew. And when your aircraft was being serviced, you went along and chatted to them and found out what they were doing and discussed it all with them. My corporal fitter, who was he taught me to drive a car. I remember I took him off to a place where I bought my second-hand Morris, 1923 Bullnose Morris, and he taught me to drive it as part of the crew's job.
Were you as well up in the mechanics of things as the airmen?
No, I wouldn't say as well up, but having had my experience at the Aircraft Disposal Company, where I'd... worked with mechanics and been a mechanic for a year, it did help me. It did help to give me some idea, some insight into what they were doing.
And what about the experience in the workshops at Cranwell? Was that useful?
Moderately useful, yes. It gave one a general idea of things.
Were you allowed to take your plane away from the base on holidays?
No, not. I don't think any fighter squadron allowed that. That happened when I went later on to the engineering course, because we couldn't fly much during the week, and the only way to get in one's flying was to do it at weekends, and then one was allowed to take aircraft away to do a long cross country and stay away, and then come back on the fly off on the Saturday and come back on the Sunday, getting in as much flying time as possible, but not while I was at 41 Squadron.
Were you allowed to decorate or modify your own plane in any way?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember ever doing that. I, I made a headrest out of metal, I remember, to keep my head still during our firing, and it was so useful that everyone else made headrests, but that's the only modification I can remember doing myself to an aircraft.
That became general in the squadron, did it?
Well, yes, it did. It helped us with our air firing.
In general terms, first of all, what was the overall pattern of training at that time in a fighter squadron? How did you first of all begin when you first went there?
Well, it was all rather haphazard in my time. When I got there, everybody was on leave, and I was confronted with a squadron of aircraft and able to do what I wished, and I used to fly an Avro almost all day until the chaps got back from leave and I started on the Siskin. The normal thing was to fly during the any time of the day one flew, but one did have a program to go through, and it was normally formation flying and radio telephony and air firing and air bombing, converging bombing, and all sorts of adaptations of that sort of thing. And there was a squadron training program, squadron attacks one had to practice, and then of course there were the air exercises every year, the annual exercises where one defended the country against raids by bomber command.
A lot of your time at Northolt was taken up with inter-squadron competitions.
Oh, very much.
Where did these take place?
Oh, very much. They were the great thing, of course, that the enemy was were the other squadrons rather than any continental foe. One competed against other squadrons in air firing and in navigation and squadron attacks and so on.
Did you do these at Northolt?
Well, we practiced at our home stations, but the finals were at an appointed fighting area station to which teams from the various squadrons would fly, and the competitions would be run there. For instance, the Sassoon Met